Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's show, using stem cells to engineer new organs. We enjoy Christmas in a typical godless household with the double act of Caspar Melville, editor of the New Humanist magazine, and comedian Robin Ince. Plus,
welcome to Jurassic Park.
You did it. You crazy son of a bitch, you did.
It turns out the movie makers got it all wrong when it came to mosquitoes trapped in amber. All you need is a bit of hair from a mammoth, and perhaps an eye of a newt for hilarious consequences. And while we're on the subject of big mammals, how to make elephants in captivity more comfortable, no, not a big comfy sofa with satellite telly, treat their big flappy ears to some of this.
He's a trusting young fellow.
And...
Scarface.
Then when you get the money, you get the power. Then when you get the power, then you get the woman.
Why money wasn't as important as that fella thought. It sounds like a movie special, but it's not. It's just good old Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, science fans. First, let me introduce the team here from The Guardian. Experts, if you will. James Randerson and Ian Sample. James, hello.
Hello.
Ian.
Hello.
You read the script today? Do you know what's coming up?
No.
Joining us this week in the pod are a duo who want to take the Christ out of Christmas. Both friends of the pod, Caspar Melville, editor of The New Humanist, and Robin Ince is a stand-up actor and writer. His more recent article in The New Humanist was entitled Religion is Bullshit. That has to be a record, having to tick all the explicit boxes after less than 3 minutes in the show. Hello to you both.
Hello.
Caspar and Robin are both here to talk about a show called Nine Lessons and Carols for Godless People. First, though, let's hear what a Christmas in an average atheist household might sound like.
Flying reindeers, balderdash. If you look at the muscle and bone structure of the animal, I think you'll find that it simply cannot generate enough propulsion. Plus, hello, no wings. Oh, and don't get me started on the aerodynamics.
Now, even if we assume the flying reindeer, there's the preposterous notion of Santa visiting all the children in the world.
No, quite so.
Now, let's assume a billion households in 24 hours. That's roughly 11,000 a second. Now, let's not beat around the bush here. That sleigh's travelling faster than the speed of light, which means that Rudolph is going to have to cope with more than just a red nose. He's going to be increasing to infinite mass.
Oh, yes, and what about that quaint Jesus story? I mean, do they really expect us to believe that Mary was a virgin?
Yes, I can think of a few more parsimonious explanations for that one. What are frankincense and myrrh, anyway?
Well, I think you'll find they're both aromatic resins made from tree sap. Hardly worthy of presenting to a king. Gold, though, now that's a dense metal.
And they reckon the three so-called wise men followed a moving star. Ridiculous!
Yes.
Astronomers actually believe it was the close approach or conjunction of the planets Venus and Jupiter with the star Regulus.
So, did you get me a present then?
No. Get me one?
No.
Oh, well, in that case, non-religiously, you can have this wool chart of British cheeses I got free with The Guardian. Oh, and this sweet from my, my pocket.
Bah, humbug! They taste horrible.
Oh, I wish I was at work. Why do I have to take all this time off?
Oh, dinner's ready then.
You know, the latest research into these ready meals show very high levels of salt, sugar and fat, not to mention the landfill.
Oh, I know, but I didn't want to do anything too extravagant, you know, like the Robinsons next door.
But it does look like they're having a lot of fun over there.
Yes, little Jimmy playing with his new train set. The grown-ups in their new jumpers. Sally riding her new bike. Not a real one, of course. Just a simulator on the Nintendo Wii. Other games consoles are also available.
Right, back to the studio now, yes. And Andy and James are both available for Panto all year. request to me. And for the record, that wasn't supposed to offend anyone. So, Robin, Casper, tell us what a godless Christmas is like. Does that, did you recognise that amazing scene that we captured earlier?
Well, it was interesting that you've totally misconstrued it by the fact that we may well doubt God, but at no point have we, at any point in our agenda, said that we doubt Santa Claus. So from that initial idea, I have to say that a lot of the idea for the show, I mean, it actually stems from Stephen Green, who is the leader of Christian Voice, who last year I was doing a TV show called London Talking. And on London Talking, I was invited on as an atheist to discuss is Britain becoming more secular, but when I arrived they said it's actually who's taking the Christ out of Christmas, and then it was mainly me. Yeah, I had actually gone around Clinton's cards, every card shop, and I'd crossed out the Christ element so people went home furious with Happy Mus cards, and so I went to every manger in Peterborough Town Square and removed the Christ element within the manger.
So the idea is this: it's called Nine Songs and Lessons for Godless People. And you've got comedians, scientists doing stand-up things, and the idea is to sort of enjoy yourself without sort of kind of resorting to God. Is that the idea?
Well, it's more that part of it was Stephen Green sat there the whole time going. I think he does want Christmas banned. I think he does, and I don't. I actually think it's a great time of year for kind of, you know, being thoughtful and drinking ginger wine. And so I wanted to make something which, with the rational element, is rather than it being a big atheist thing, it's more a celebration of science. So all the comedians going on, whether it's Chris Addison or Josie Long or Stuart Lee, will be talking about something joyous that they've discovered from the scientific or philosophical world. And then we've got people like Richard Dawkins and Simon Singh and The Guardian's Ben Goldacre. I don't know how we're going to keep him down to his 8 minutes, because once he starts, it's never going to, someone's going to shout, "What about MMR?" And many hours later, and long after Christmas has passed. So the idea is, it's a bit, part of it's really based from Richard Feynman at the beginning of The Pleasure of Finding Things Out, the BBC documentary, ends the first bit by going, science, it doesn't subtract, it only adds. And the idea is that hopefully some people will leave the show and think, I must read more about this, and that it's saying you can be celebratory, you don't have to just be snippy and snippy atheists.
I'm going to come back to this question of where science and comedy actually intersects, because a lot of people might disagree that science is fun at all, which we try and disprove every week on the show. But Casper, how did The New Humanist get involved? I mean, you're a serious magazine looking at very sort of deep philosophical issues. So tell us how you're involved.
Sorry, can I just quickly say, you said a serious magazine, and I believe the centre spread on this month is a Top Trumps of Religion.
All right, yes, exactly. I was going to come back to it. Go on.
Let the man have his say. Our deep respect for Santa Claus by depicting him as Alexei Sale falling down a chimney on the cover. So I spent years and years planning this, contacting all the comedians. No, I didn't. Robin came to me with the idea, the whole show, all the connections, and said that he wanted to. He didn't want to make money for himself. He wanted to, contribute to the coffers of the Rationalist Association, which is the organisation that produces the magazine, and specifically to Mustard Seed School, which is a secular school in Uganda that we support. So, I mean, I'd published Robin a few times before, and as you couldn't possibly tell from what he just said, Robin really is a frustrated science nerd in the guise of a comedian. So this desire to bring together, Richard Dawkins and comedians and Ben Goldacre obviously suits what New Humanist does a lot, which is to try and balance, serious scientific and philosophical discussion, talking about humanism and atheism, with jokes, having fun and being positive, not just knocking religion. It's not really about bashing religion at all, actually.
Robin, how did you persuade Richard Dawkins to appear on the same bill all these sort of top class comedians? Ricky Gervais, for example. How do you persuade him?
Well, I persuaded him by pretending that none of those people would be there, and it would just be a celebration of his
Had
life.
He heard of these people? Had he heard of them? Does his sort of intellectual sort of capacities descend to this sort of level of normal people?
Well, he does. I mean, in his books every now and again, he does reference things like Monty Python. He was a huge fan of Douglas Adams. It'll be interesting because he's quite sure. I mean, I obviously, the simplest way of meeting Richard Dawkins is to make sure that you're on Richard and Judy the same day he is. That's how this came about. I was Richard Dawkins was brilliantly sandwiched between a wag talking about breast augmentation with Tony Parsons and me showing some clips from the internet of a horse doing a poo on a lady's head, and in between was Richard Dawkins talking about his new Charles Darwin series.
How did I miss that episode?
It was such brilliant. A great... And again, everything could be analysed from an... You know, the breast augmentation, obviously, Dawkins, you could see there, analysing how that would be an evolutionary advantage or disadvantage, and whether horses poo on ladies' heads or not. You know, how that has actually happened over 4.6 billion years.
Well, the stuff for the other comedians going to bring up, have they let you know what sort of things they're going to be talking about?
Not really. Everyone's... I mean, Chris Addison has done a series about evolution in the past, so I think he'll probably be approaching from an evolutionary angle. Josie Long, I think, will be talking about astronomy. Mm. She has some very nice stuff about that. I have no idea what Stuart Lee's going to do, and I have no idea what... I know Dara O'Brien's very excited by it because he is someone who is trained up in physics, and I think he wants to play to an audience where... I mean, what I always find frightening about, especially the first audiences, which I think will be very scientist heavy, is quite often I do gigs and I can see some of the audience going, what's he talking about? Whereas with the science audience, your worry is they're going, what's he talking about? He hasn't understood Heisenberg whatsoever. This man's a fool. So
are they going to heckle? You think there'll be sort of UCF saying more complicated?
I don't think they'll heckle, but I think there will be, you know, treaties left afterwards, and the theatre will actually have addendum written all over it and notations. But I think, yeah, the comics will be covering quite a broad array of ideas, and the musicians as well will be. I believe Gavin Osborne will be singing a lovely song about the sexual behaviour of bonobos. Excellent. Which is one of my favourite things.
Which is another good point to stop this section of the interview, probably. We're going to come back to you two at the end of the programme, but in the meantime, if you're desperate to see their pictures, go to newhumanist.org.uk or skeptic.org.uk. It's being called a giant leap forward for surgery. A patient's own stem cells have been used to grow a new organ. Surgeons replaced a section of Claudia Castillo's windpipe with a donated organ that was stripped of its cells and used as a scaffold for her stem cells. Scientists now believe it will transform the future of surgery as it raises the prospect of transplants for patients whose organs are damaged by cancer. They can't take drugs as they increase the risk of cancer returning. But what does it all mean? Ian, are you going to take us through some of what actually happened in this procedure?
So what happened is they took part of the windpipe from a donor, stripped out all the cells because they're the bits that are going to make the immune system of the patient receiving it go haywire and reject it. Then they basically grew some epithelial cells. These are like coating cells, if you like, onto the outside of it. And then they put a load of cartilage stem cells. Basically, these are stem cells that they turned into cartilage that they'd actually taken from the woman's own bone marrow. So the only bit that was made from stem cells was this cartilage bit, which people know quite well how to make cartilage out of stem cells. It is a really good thing, but if you're going to make an organ in this way, then making a pipe is going to be the easiest bit. This is like making a sort of a TV lead, whereas making another organ is actually like trying to tissue engineer the TV. If you wanted to use this kind of technique to make a kidney or a liver, which is this big 3D organ with multiple types of cells, all in very special places, in positions to each other, that's a whole new ball game.
I mean, they've made bladders before as well. I mean, is anything more complicated on the cards there?
Bags and pipes mostly.
Bagpipes.
So yeah, we may get some tissue engineered instruments coming along. I say people have looked at livers, but again, long way away.
Okay, and this whole thing almost never happened because of a low cost airline, I believe. Robin, you've been looking at this.
According to the papers on Friday, EasyJet refused to. I don't know why they refused to transport it. I couldn't actually work this out because I don't think it was just someone waving around this kind of load. It wasn't like a David Cronenberg film. Can we just bring on this kind of strange, fleshy, gloopy thing? I imagine it was in an ice box at the very least.
Surgery took place in Spain, but the stem cells were grown in Bristol, the sort of centre there. And I think the researchers there had 14 hours, apparently, to transport this valuable cargo, first in the world thing, to Spain. And the EasyJet checking staff thought, hang on a minute, that could be dangerous.
Is it because Stelios has actually made a cheaper version of the windpipes, which he will hope
easy
to have?
Stem right, cell, yeah. Easy stem cell.
Easy throat.
We'll leave easy throat there. Let's take a look at some of the other science stories around this week. Here's Ian and James with your News Jam.
News Jam.
Scientists have sequenced the genome of the woolly mammoth, the first time this has been done with an extinct animal. The team analysed hairs plucked from carcasses of 18 recovered from the Siberian permafrost. they managed to piece together 3.3 billion pairs of DNA letters that make up around 70% of the animal's genetic code. The genome differs from that of the African elephant by only 0.6%.
A government-appointed task force has rejected presumed consent for organ donors. The chief medical officer, Sir Liam Donaldson, has argued that by assuming that every UK citizen is willing to donate their organs if they die, unless they specifically opt out, that will improve donation rates. However, the inquiry said there is no evidence for this and it would risk destroying the trust patients and families have with their doctors. Instead, officials have suggested a series of measures to increase organ donation by other means.
And finally, facial scars can make men more attractive to the opposite sex. British psychologists found that women who are contemplating a brief relationship preferred men with mild facial scars over ones with less rugged-looking faces. Men, however, showed no preference over whether women were scarred or not.
So let's look at a couple of those stories a bit more closely. Firstly, woolly mammoth. Ian's been speaking to Michael Hofreiter at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig.
One problem is that usually if you extract DNA from a fossil, you don't only have the DNA from the species, but you have mostly DNA for bacteria and fungi. And the second problem is that the DNA in fossils is very much fragmented. So in modern DNA, you can sequence up to 800 base pairs. For ancient DNA, you get maybe 120, if you're very good, 140 base pairs on average. So the sequences are much, much shorter.
Do you think it might tell us anything about why they ended up going extinct, whereas obviously African and Asian elephants carry on?
No, actually, I don't think so. So in my opinion, a genome sequence will never tell us why they went extinct, because it's not due to, let's say, genetic inabilities, it's rather due to chance effects like humans hunting them or the environment changing too fast for the animals to adapt. But I don't think that has anything to do with the genetic factors, really.
So the question everyone wants to know is, are we going to be seeing woolly mammoths walking on the earth again from research like this?
Well, I wouldn't exclude it for all the times, though I think it's, even if we look far into the future, highly unlikely. I'm very sure that neither you nor me will see it ever.
But there's two ways. I mean, cloning is going to be really difficult, but there's another way you could be able to look at doing this, at least theoretically.
Well, I mean, cloning is out of the question, because for cloning you would need intact cells, and these just don't exist for mammoths. The other way to go would be to make one way or the other kind of a transgenic elephant, or in vitro synthesize, chemically synthesize the chromosomes. But for both ways, actually, we totally lack the technologies at the moment. So we are not able to synthesize anyhow, in any case, long enough stretches of DNA. And we are also not able to make a transgenic elephant. And I very much doubt people will put in the money, time, and effort to do these things. I couldn't see what the point of it would be.
That was Michael Hofreiter at the Max Planck Institute in Leipzig. Anyone got any questions here in the pod? I heard there's a story, Ian, that the hair that this stuff came from, this whole research came from, you can get it on eBay now.
Well, I think the original researchers got their hair from eBay.
How much does mammoth hair go for on eBay?
I don't know. I think it was very little. I mean, if you get change out of a fiver. The paper had a picture of the hair, and it was a suspiciously sort of familiar-looking ball of hair. And you thought, well, I really hope that this is from a mammoth, and they haven't just been sold something dodgy.
They apparently did check out the seller, and they were licensed to sell this stuff. So
licensed to sell mammoth hair?
Yeah. No, we shouldn't encourage our listeners to buy mammoth hair on eBay.
Is there a big black market?
There is
mammoth
huge
hair?
Well, you know, maybe huge after this program.
On to something a bit more serious. Organ donation, James. Now, the story is not finished yet. The decision hasn't been made by the government, so take us through it.
Yeah, this is a case of a government-appointed expert committee not coming up with the right answer, because Sir Liam Donaldson, as we know, is very keen on the idea of presumed consent, and so is Gordon Brown, and so they set up this expert committee. Now,
to tell them why they were right.
Exactly, and they were rather disappointed with the results. So, I mean, in the short term, it means this idea will be sort of kicked into the long grass. But, I mean, they seem to be so keen on it, the government, that I think it will be resurrected after a while. I mean, one of the countries that is always held up here as you know, one we should be emulating is Spain, because their organ donation rate is about 3 times higher than us. And of course they have this presumed consent, and so people have always used this as an argument for having presumed consent. But actually, the head of the transplant authority there, Rafael Matasanz, had a piece on Comment is Free saying, actually, our rates are not all about presumed consent. It's about all the other things we do, like having enough trained people in hospitals to talk to bereaved relatives and things like that. So
it's more about the network than the fact that you can just harvest organs as soon as...
You might argue he would say that, since he's in charge of all that, and he's kind of saying what we do is really great and I'm in charge of it. But I don't know. He's saying it's not as simple as just presumed consent.
Not enough time to mention the scar on the face research here, but suffice to say, ladies, James cut himself shaving this morning. Find out what's making you weak at the knees, guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
We'll be looking at how to make an elephant happy in just a moment, but first, some feedback. Let's take a look at the blogs following last week's show.
Parky DR points out 01010100 is T, not Triumph. That would be 01010100111010100111011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011011
Without taking this to the dizzying heights of the Guardian's readers' editor for a formal correction, we admit that what we said was technically wrong last week, but we didn't want to spend the whole programme reeling off ones and zeros.
Or maybe we did.
Yeah. Maybe that's an idea for a special one-off podcast. Now a thread from Woolly-Minded Liberal.
Why should we use dark energy to generate electricity when we already get oodles of gigawatts of sunlight for free and we know what sunlight is and how to use it?
So incensed with those words, he decided to reply to himself with an idea that just popped into his mind.
If no one wants a food-based collective term for Guardian journalists, then how about an organic food box or a recycling of Guardian journalists? Another light bulb then lit up. The collective noun for blog contributors must be a shirk, since most of us are clearly shirking our work to post here. I'm proud of my ability to multi-shirk.
Casper and Robin, this is just a reference to a discussion we had last week. We're trying to work out what the collective noun for a group of Guardian journalists was. My favourite, particularly, was a typo of Guardian journalists. There was also yogurt and lentil.
And sheep
of Guardian journalists. Sandal. Any ideas? A sandal of Guardian journalists.
I think if you could just call it a little John of Guardian journalists, just to annoy him. Guardianistas.
I've got an entire little John over there of people. Okay, we'll see if you're able to multi-shirk, either join our Facebook group and post something on the wall, or leave a little text present on the blog, now at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Researchers have discovered that playing music like this to elephants in zoos reduces abnormal behaviour such as swaying, pacing and trunk tossing. I never thought I'd find myself saying that. James, now you wrote this story and interviewed the lady about trunk tossing. Tell us more.
Yes, this is researchers at Queen's University in Belfast, and they compared the elephant behaviour over a number of days without playing any music, just having normal kind of zoo background noises, and then with a classical CD, which
Moods?
Well, yeah, something like that. It was a kind of compilation CD of classics, best hits, or something like that. And then they went back to the quiet sort of treatment. And then they compared the behaviour, and all the abnormal behaviours were much reduced, whereas normal things like feeding were the same as before.
Any reasons for this? Did they think, you know, perhaps the classical music soothed them, or were they just scared that it was coming from somewhere that was going to attack them, and so they stayed still? What?
People have done similar experiments like this with dogs, and it works quite well with dogs. Dogs actually prefer classical music, or at least they're calmer with classical music than with heavy metal. They've done it with gorillas as well.
Gorillas like classical music?
They do, yeah.
That's amazing. Robin, you've got to have a question about this.
Do you know what? I haven't. I've always known that elephants, ever since I heard about how they discovered the elephant's self-conscious, which is one of my favourite experiments, which is to get an animal asleep and then just put a dot on its head, and if it wakes up and looks in the mirror and goes, "Ooh, it's Charlie's done that," I think that's such a fantastic thing. And I'm a big fan of the elephant, though I don't own one myself, which is a great pity.
I'd like to know exactly which bits of classical music they like. But anyway, I spoke to David Field, who's zoological director of London and Whipsnade Zoos, about the research, and he actually said that the elephants at Whipsnade Zoo, they play Terry Wogan and Chilton FM too. Chilton
Radio. Science Weekly.
Let's get back to our guests, Robert and Casper, now. The intersection between comedy and science, you know. I don't want to make this a serious question, but seriously, why is there such an overlap?
Well, I think at the moment there are, and there have been for a while, a lot of comedians who are also very obsessed with, well, they like, people like learning. I mean, one of the great things about, it used to be that teachers would, people like Jim Bowen or Tom O'Connor, would become comedians. And now I think a lot of comedians really want to become teachers, but not proper teachers, because the pay's terrible and the hours are awful. Whereas doing an hour-long show about science is quite, it's that whole thing where you've turned your job into an exciting piece of revision. I mean, one of my favourite gigs that I've ever done was at Sheffield University, where a young woman came up to me, probably about 19 years old, and a lot of comedians, you know, would go, oh, imagine that 19-year-old woman, brilliant. You know, did you get off with her? No, something much, much better than that happened. She said, could I have a reading list based around some of the people that I talked about? And I was there going, giving her reading list based around Carl Sagan's books and Richard Feynman's. And I think that's just something quite exciting, as well as being able... as a stand-up, you need to be enthusiastic and you need to be passionate. And I think you do. And you know, looking into the world of science and the world of philosophy and all these, you know, this incredible history of you know, 3,000 years or more, is just a great thing to. It's great subject matter as well.
It's also weirder than fiction in many ways, isn't it? The good thing about the real world is that sometimes it can be so surprising. What things like dark matter, string theory, that kind of stuff, is just so weird and bizarre that you couldn't actually make that sort of stuff up anyway.
In our magazine, we've got a little feature which is, you know, based on the show, and it's for some of the performers. And the piece that Ricky Gervais did precisely says, you know, here's a story, you know, it's a religious story. It's not really interesting because it's not true. But how about this story? And he just sort of tells a little story of a microbe which infects a fish in some way to stop it from being able to see the shadow of the heron. And then the heron is able to eat the fish because the microbe really wants to get into the heron. Mm. And that's absolutely, you know, and he says, isn't that amazing? So never mind string theory or some of this kind of speculative stuff. The amazing stuff is there. All around. I mean, my son's obsessed with, you know, viperfish, and the poor little viperfish male that attaches to the female, it's tiny compared to the female, it attaches to the female, and then all its organs stop working apart from its testicles, and then and then it just drifts away, you know, just is kind of overwhelmed by the power of the female fish.
God Trumps, can you tell us a bit more about those?
First of all, the idea came from Christina Martin, who's a stand-up comedian herself, and she's written for us before. She will be doing one of the nights, the godless nights, and she is just one of these great people who kind of keeps her eyes on, you know, sends in silly stuff that she finds. She came up with this idea, which originally it was something to do with rights trumps, because she had come across a story about, you know, does the right to, you know, of a homosexual to practice their homosexuality trump the right of a Christian? So she wanted to do a rights trump thing. Then it kind of morphed into God Trumps, and so. And we then got Martin Rosen, who's our cartoonist and illustrator, involved, and did some fantastic, although on occasion incredibly inaccurate caricatures. I'm talking about the atheist one here. So we poked some fun. We did 12 cards. We've had, you know, as I said, hundreds of thousands of people have gone online. Lots of complaints. Where are the Mormons? Where are the Amish? Where are the Fulangong? You know, there was even a complaint.
You say, like, complaints from the Catholics.
No, but there was even one complaint from someone who was like, who worked for the Alpha Course, and he was a Christian. And who had said, you know, what about Christian Orthodox? You know, they're really weird. What, try them. But he loved it, and he was circulating it around to people. So in a strange way, it doesn't seem at the moment to have triggered, you know, the traditional offence idea, that people just seem to think it's fun. And the best thing happened to me. I was doing this thing called Faith Direct, you know, which is a kind of sponsored by Wandsworth Council, and going and talking to all religious groups, and I was representing non-belief. And I was talking to this group of teenagers, and then I had to go away and to do something. And when I got back to the table, they'd ripped them out of the magazine and were playing.
This is brings me on to the Muslim top Trump,
yes.
which essentially is, isn't it, a caricature of a Muslim chap. But there's no points on this one. It just has ultimate Trump card. No jokes can be made here at all. Do you really feel you can't make any jokes about Islam?
Do I really feel you can't make jokes? I don't, actually. I thought it was a good gag. I do think it's a good gag in the context of this. It is tough. It's a tough climate to make jokes about religion, but it's so important to do so. And I think what Robin does, and what Nick Doody, for example, wrote a piece for us just last time about how do you make jokes about religion. And he said, you've got to balance between pandering to racists and xenophobes and people who've always found something wrong with foreigners and their beliefs, and wanting to make very good gags about very silly ideas, which is absolutely our right, and people enjoy it. And, you know, people who have their beliefs shouldn't feel threatened by that. That's fine. And we love taking the mick out of, you know, Richard Dawkins and everyone else and Robin Ince and all of you lot.
Yeah, I think that one of the most important things is that it has to be well informed. If you're going to do jokes about religion, then make sure you've done a bit of background reading first of all. And that this is why when Ben Elton talked about the fact the BBC told him he couldn't have any Muslim jokes, my thoughts are probably that they were just crass, broad jokes that he hadn't perhaps done any background. I mean, that's the hardest thing, I think, is that most people would. It is a very thin line between. Christopher Hitchens was asked that. Hey, are you ever worried that due to, you know, the culture and religion, the crossover of them, that sometimes it'll appear what he says is racist? Mm-hmm. To which he replied, "You calling me a racist, madam? No, I didn't. Stand up and say that." I was standing up. It was a lovely joke. Yeah, it really was that one of those moments where, and everyone applauded like atheist sheep.
This is very good. This is very good. Casper, Robin, both thank you very, very much for all that. Thanks also to James and to Ian. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. We'll be back next week. Happy holidays.